the Northern Sun Radio News Show with Don Olson and Dave Gutnick. And Dave, you want to start us off?
Sure. Thanks, Don. And first, a quick announcement or two. Don, I'll ask you about next week's program, but I want to mention also that last night the new film Cuba After Castro, directed by Abby Martin, was shown at the Main Cinema and will be shown again at WAM, Women Against Military Madness, at their 42nd and Chicago Avenue offices on Monday, September 14th. That's the showing of Cuba After Castro.
Yes, and we won't be having a show next week at the State Fair, but we'll be back in 2 weeks.
All right, well, it's a good thing there's fun and music somewhere, because the international news is not encouraging. Today we'll have much commentary on the U.S. wars in Ukraine and Iran. There also are other wars Trump is waging and almost entirely losing. No doubt he and his criminal cohort regard the kidnapping of the Venezuela president and the takeover of Venezuela oil production as a kind of success. Actually, it was an ugly and criminal one. Decades of attacking the lives and economy in Cuba. Is that a success? In West Asia, the late February attacks by the U.S. and Israel failed to achieve regime change in Iran through the favorite Israel tactic of assassinations and the favorite U.S. tactic of bombing without publicly introducing ground forces. Trump and his clown show administration now have the Secretary of Treasury leading the war on Iran, which it is and has been losing militarily, diplomatically, and economically. The new sanctions are predicted to fail, and we'll be returning to that. The U.S. is also losing the strategic confrontation against Russia in Ukraine at great cost, the horrible outcome of a few decades of NATO expansion and using Ukraine as a sacrificial victim in the war of the West on Russia. But the U.S. and its subordinate allies have run low on air defense missiles and other munitions, and nothing adequate will be manufactured soon, according to all of the forecast. Meanwhile, the U.S. is in dire financial circumstances without a clear plan to avoid ever-increasing inflation. Further, the U.S. is losing a strategic confrontation with China in several key areas, including AI technology, and trillions of U.S. dollar investments are at risk when that bubble bursts. And now we have tariff madness and a breakdown in relations with our largest trading partner, Canada. Had enough losses yet? How about U.S. support for the genocidal behavior of Israel, reinforcing an appalling loss in lives and human dignity? In an interview titled Trump's Madness, here is just a couple minutes or less with the recent example of what is being allowed and encouraged there. This is by Phil Giraldi, former CIA officer on the Judge Napolitano program. Just be right with you. Here we go.
It's kind of disgusting, but I have to ask you this. Why did West Bank terrorists torture a donkey?
Well, this is because this is the kind of people they are. They go into Palestinian villages on the West Bank. These are the settlers. They go into Palestinian villages, they kill people, they torture people, they will also kill livestock, because the livestock and the trees with the olives are what the Palestinian families need to survive to sell these products. In this case, they beat a man up. A Palestinian man, a Christian, incidentally. They took his donkey, a very gentle, peaceful animal. They tied it to the back of their pickup truck and dragged him till he died. They tortured him to death. This is the kind of people we're dealing with.
Well, that's enough. You get the flavor. That's what we're sponsoring over there. Okay, losses upon losses, not to be blamed solely on a mentally deranged president because he sits atop a declining and desperate empire. The clips from his Truth Social platform that I have seen are bombastic, impulsive, a disgrace, a pathetic embarrassment of the person leading the United States. But they, again, are a manifestation of U.S. decline and desperation. Now I'll quote some other folks besides myself. Here's the New York Times, no less, on tariffs. President Trump's repeated attempts to impose tariffs have become an encapsulation of his second term. They have hurt the American economy and his own popularity. They also range from legally dubious to blatantly illegal. He has tried to get around court rulings far more often than his predecessors. With lower courts, he has openly flouted judges' decisions, including in January, when he violated nearly 100 court orders related to immigration. With the Supreme Court, he has been more respectful, but has still engaged in, quote, legalistic noncompliance, as the scholars Daniel D. T. Deacon and Leah M. Littman have written. It involves, quote, an array of specious legal arguments and legalisms in an attempt to conceal what is actually widespread resistance to judicial oversight, unquote. Mr. Trump has taken this approach with tariffs, immigration, and funding freezes. The U.S. Supreme Court justices have shown themselves willing to stand up to some of Mr. Trump's worst abuses of power on tariffs, birthright citizenship, and false claims of election fraud, yet they have sometimes shown an unfortunate deference to him and even undercut lower court judges who are trying to uphold the law. Incredibly, the 1930 law that he has used to justify the Canadian tariffs is the Smoot-Hawley Tariff Act, a law notorious for contributing to the Great Depression. Now let's turn briefly to the U.S.-Canadian trade war, which is much in the news. Here's some comments by Patrick Lawrence, one of the editors and contributors at consortiumnews.com. It's a piece on the breakdown of negotiations. The previous passage I read to you tells, even in the New York Times, about the breakdown of constitutional order. All right, now we have specifics of breakdown of negotiations. Americans attempted to insert last-minute unacceptable demands in a New York Times opinion piece on August 24th under the headline, America Came for Canada, We Said No. A Toronto journalist named Stephen March put the case this way, quote, for Canada, the choice came down to either severe but temporary economic instability or binding itself to a pseudo-democratic fiscal basket case of a nation whose only apparent foreign policy objective has become domination for the gratification of the president's slapdash vanity, unquote. My added comment, when and how this deep dispute will be modified is unclear. Not quickly, in any case. This will have huge impacts on both Canadian and U.S. economies and other global supply chain participants, even if it were to be resolved quickly, which is unlikely. Now, a few things specific about diesel, which is again in the news. The shortage is being exacerbated by an anticipated drop in Canadian oil, which is the U.S. chief source of heavy petroleum, the heavy type that we need in order to generate diesel and jet fuel. And we don't generate enough of that in the U.S. And let's see, Prime Minister Mark Carney had a powerful response, which was probably 40 minutes, but it was really very, very good. And he pointed out that Canada is the source of 70% of the imported electricity. That's primarily hydropower from eastern Canada. 80% of the petroleum imports of the U.S. come from Canada, and something like 80% of natural gas. So there's a huge mutual dependence there. This is very far from one way. One powerful line in Prime Minister Mark Carney's address, talking about the agreements made with the U.S., we recognize that sometimes its agreements are written in pencil. Now back to the diesel shortage. Again, the U.S. needs Canadian oil very much. our number one supply, the ones in the Gulf of Mexico, eventually gets there. They're not getting any much yet from Venezuela, although that is the plan, what they were set up for. Industry expert Carl Miller summarized the current outlook, quote, "The physical shortage has caught up with the market. Over the next 30 days, this is diesel now, that scarcity will transmit directly into regional availability, freight costs, food prices, agricultural production, industrial output, and inflation. The second wave is already forming. Natural gas and fertilizer scarcity will carry the energy shock into the 2026-27 growing cycle and food supply," unquote. And comment from Eve Smith at nakedcapitalism.com, "Price is already rationing demand. U.S. diesel has moved from a normal cost environment into scarcity pricing. The national average rose from $3.47 per gallon at the start of the year to $5.65 on August 24th. Every measure, every regional network is material higher. The Gulf Coast and Rocky Mountain regions are up more than 70%. That price move is not the shortage itself. It is the market's attempt to ration limited physical supply." Now, Don, you said there was something to pay for. Did you have anything to add on the diesel bit?
Well, it's on the front page of the Star Tribune's business section about how it's affecting like one farmer in Iowa that would be paying for now to the rest of the year $40,000 for diesel, twice what he would normally be paying. And it's and just so you maybe understand, refineries produce diesel, gasoline, jet fuel, and other fuels by cracking or heating crude oil. And the United States and China have most of the world's refining capacity, followed by countries such as Russia and China. And the U.S. is making quite a bit of money now because they're, of course, they're selling it at the world prices. And so they're running at 97% of their capacity, according to the Energy Information Administration. And so it's exports of diesel is up about 28% from last year. And the U.S. inventories of those fuels have fallen sharply.
Yeah, that's key. See, the inventories have fallen sharply, and they're pushing production as hard as they can, and there's an immediate threat of restricted imports of Canadian oil, which is essential to this topic. All right, well, I'm going to move on to specifics about Iran and the threat of economic war and the actions of Treasury Secretary Bessent. Some oil is getting through the Strait of Hormuz, apparently by Iranian permission, but how much is in dispute? Exaggerated U.S. claims are belied by official neutral reports of ship traffic in the Gulf of Hormuz, which are available to anyone online, by the way. Here's a quote from Bloomberg. Quote, "Kuwait and Qatar are sending more crude through the Strait of Hormuz, adding to an increase in shipments that are keeping global prices in check. The two countries have managed to get shipments back to 70% of pre-conflict levels, with a total of around 7 to 8 million barrels of oil a day now exiting Hormuz." Now, again, this is strongly disputed by the official neutral ship tracking sites as well as by Iran. So Bloomberg is a typical establishment pro-administration voice, and these numbers they're citing are quite doubtful.
Some people claim that ships are turning off their transponders.
Yeah, that's undoubtedly happening, but the strait isn't that wide, and Iran can can keep track of everything, both with its own and, you know, website trackers that are available to everyone. And so this is the importance of the phrase mentioned earlier. Some oil is getting through, apparently by Iranian permission, okay? But the basic fact is they have a high degree of control of what's going on there. Incidentally, very encouraging, one bit of encouraging news that just came out in the last day or two is that it appears that Iran and Oman are very close to an agreement on the management of the strait, including fees and specific routes and so on and so on. So this has been in the works for a while, and it looks encouraging for some agreement there, which would clarify some parts of the conflict at least.
But Trump doesn't like that they're not going through him.
Yeah, right. Let's call it the Gulf of America, Strait of America. That's his brilliant idea. And no less an establishment voice than the prestigious Foreign Affairs magazine put the situation bluntly. Quote, "The American Middle East is finished. The regional order that has prevailed since 1991 has been one of the many casualties of the U.S.-Israeli war with Iran. The American and Israeli failure to dislodge the regime in Iran, Tehran, has proved the bankruptcy of decades of sanctions and violence. The inability of the United States to protect its Gulf allies from Iranian attacks or to keep the Strait of Hormuz open has fatally undermined the core security bargain that justified its network of military bases in the region. And Israel's increasingly threatening posture and abandonment of any pretense of interest in reaching an accommodation with the Palestinians have ended Washington's decades-long mission of bringing its Arab allies and Israel together into an enduring security partnership." Now, once again, this is one of the most powerful voices of the establishment at Foreign Affairs, and they laid it out pretty clearly there that this is a change in the whole power structure of that region and the U.S. role there. Now I've got just 4 minutes, kind of a overview, if you will, from Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, again on the Judge Napolitano show, talking about the real cost of American intervention and how reliable is Trump. What do you think?
I mean, remember what Nelson Mandela said. Nelson Mandela said, if there's a war somewhere between two countries, go see which one was called by the United States first.
Wow.
He was right.
I'm going to move to Iran, but this is wonderful, a clip that Chris found of a Revolutionary Guard spokesperson analyzing Trump and the words he uses. So before I ask you if you still think the president is off his rocker, listen to a very, very sophisticated analysis of Donald Trump by this IRGC spokesperson, Chris, cut number 18.
This period has specific characteristics, including being very short-sighted, meaning a childish behavior. There is no foresight in what is being said, meaning when they speak, they don't even think about, say, 24 hours later. An important major international leader must see the depth of their words, even 50 or 100 years into the future, that will be recorded in history. But their characteristic is that they can't even predict up to tomorrow and, so to speak, make a statement that is measured, forward-looking, and based on foresight. His words have no basis or foundation. But his statements have damaged America's power. We don't rely on these words at all. I mean, I rely on this driver's word much more because he shows up on time. But he keeps saying things that are proven false the very next day. You shouldn't rely on these words too much at all. In my opinion, the media shouldn't pay much attention to the words of the current U.S. president either, who just says useless things everywhere.
Couldn't have said it better myself.
Right. A cab driver brought me to this interview, and he's more reliable than the president of the United States.
He summed it up.
Yeah. Is Trump mentally degraded?
I think so. I do. I'm getting more and more emails every day from people I've never heard of in my life, but their credentials are quite stunning when I read them. And they're from the psychiatric community, the psychological, whatever you want to call it, all these different professors of this, that, and the other thing. And the one thing that I think I read in my neophyte's mind about these sorts of issues, about which I know very little, is dementia and narcissism and displaying these things and these qualities in a way that is, shall we say, in, should be indicative to some process to remove him from office.
Well, how deep of a quagmire is he in now, Colonel? Does he have any off-ramp besides declaring victory and coming home?
Not much, and I don't see him doing that, so he has no off-ramp at all. I just don't see this individual doing that, and unfortunately, we've allowed him to pack his administration in such a way that all these people like Steve Miller comes to mind immediately, the chief of staff comes to mind immediately, Pete Hegseth comes to mind immediately, J.D. Vance even comes to mind immediately. All these people's futures are vested in this man. And they can't step back and suddenly oppose him. And so we've walked ourselves into, including the Supreme Court and the legislature, the supine legislature, which should be the check if Madison was right in any way, fashion, or form, the people's representatives, the body closest to the people ought to check him. If that's not done, we're in for a hell of a ride. I mean, someone, Ray McGovern, said last night in an email, we're in 1933 Germany, and we're the Germans.
That, again, is Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson on the Justin Napolitano show. He had quite a bit of experience very high up in quarters of power in Washington a few administrations back. Now, a couple more bits of news from the West Asia. Qatar Prime Minister and Foreign Minister today is in Tehran for talks on the conflict. And these two countries have been in a lot of conflict and on the Gulf of Hormuz. Meanwhile, Iran's official press TV makes clear the Iranian position. Just to summarize again what the barrier to a real resolution is, they say the Strait of Hormuz will remain closed unless the United States halts its blockade and accepts Tehran's conditions for implementing a recent memorandum of understanding, said the spokesman of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Brigadier General Hossein Mohibi said on Wednesday the strategic waterway is firmly under Iranian control and that hostile military forces have been pushed back. Now, I've got a couple clips, well, actually two from John Mearsheimer and in between a one from Jeffrey Sachs. Mearsheimer, well-known University of Chicago historian, giving a rather blunt summary of Besant and U.S. incompetence and a morally bankrupt West.
My dear friend, before we get to Britain and Russia, can the plans, if you can call them plans, outlined by Secretary of the Treasury Besant yesterday, in your view, effectively strangle Iran so that it cries uncle, so to speak?
No, there's no question in my mind, excuse me, that this is not going to work. And let me give you a couple reasons. First of all, the United States and Israel represent an existential threat to Iran. And for that reason, Iran is going to fight to the death. They're not going to roll over easily. They understand that they're fighting for their life. That's the first point. The second point is that for this to work, the United States has to get virtually all of Iran's major trading partners to sever all economic intercourse with Iran. And that's not going to happen. If you look at the countries that Iran depends heavily on, maybe number one is China. And the Chinese have already said they're not going to play ball. I do not believe the Turks, who are another big trading partner, are going to play ball with the United States. The Russians are not going to play ball with the United States. And in fact, the European Union does a great deal of trade with Iran, and it'll be very interesting to see how successful we are at coercing the Europeans into cutting off all economic intercourse with Iran. Then there's the whole subject of retaliation. I think if you look at the list of countries that import and export with Iran, what you see is that one of the key countries, in addition to China, is the United Arab Emirates. And the UAE lives right next door to Iran and has been attacked by Iran before. And the Iranians are telling the UAE that if they join in on this blockade against Iran, Iran will wreck their economy. It will wreck their country. So the UAE has to think long and hard about whether it wants to join with the United States and cut off all economic intercourse to Iran. And I'm not sure that they're going to be willing to do it. But even if the UAE goes along, the end result is the UAE is going to be wrecked, number one. And number two, other countries like China, Turkey, Pakistan, Russia are going to continue to trade. So those are some of the key points. And the final point that I'd make is that everybody understands that a blockade of this sort takes time to work. It doesn't happen overnight. And the fact is that we don't have time on our side, given the state of the international economy, given that there's an upcoming midterm election. President Trump has a deep-seated interest in making this work as soon as possible, but it's going to take time. And then when you add in all the other factors, this is simply not going to work.
It seems naive, Professor, on the part of Secretary Bessent. I don't know if he's economically illiterate or just burdened by a boss, President Trump, who is economically illiterate, at least in the ways of international economics. But it does seem naive. I mean, why would a Chinese bank risk breaking Chinese law by complying with an American sanction? Why would they think that the bank would do that?
Well, the other thing you want to keep in mind before we talk about Bessent is that the rest of the world, for the most part, has a vested interest in seeing us lose in Iran. I mean, forget the blockade. If you're Chinese or you're Russian or you're Turkish, the last thing you want to see happen here is the United States defeat Iran. You want to see Iran win the war. So you want to always keep in mind that that underlying motivation is sitting out there.
And it gives, do the Turks want to see Iran win the war?
Because if Iran loses, then the Israelis and the Americans will put their gun sights on Turkey. You understand that the Turks have deep-seated interest in making sure that Iran shows that it can stand up to the Israelis and that Iran doesn't fold. Because we've been listening to the Israelis talk for weeks now, if not months now, that Turkey is the threat number one after Iran. So once Iran's done with, we'll turn to Turkey. It's all part of the Greater Israel Project. So the Turks will go to great lengths to make sure that the Iranians survive.
And what will the United States do? United States, the only country in the world that harms its allies. What will the United States do to its so-called allies that basically tell Scott Bessent to go fly a kite?
Nothing. I mean, what are they going to do? Bessent has made it clear that he understands that if he pushes too hard and too fast, he'll crash the international economy. He's effectively said that. He knows he's playing with fire here. And this gets back to your question a minute ago about whether or not Bessent is just a fool or he's naive or what have you. I mean, I find it hard to believe that somebody who has operated in financial markets for as long as Bessent has and who has to understand how the international economy works a lot better than you and I do hasn't figured out that this is a non-starter. He must know that. He can't be that foolish. I mean, if you listen to virtually all the commentary on this blockade, hardly anybody thinks it's going to succeed. I've not heard anybody tell a plausible story about how we're going to completely isolate Iran economically and bring it to its knees. Nobody has a plausible story to tell. Bessette must understand this. And all of this, of course, gets back to the fact that this is an administration that makes decisions. And in fact, the February 8th, 28th decision to go to war fits in this category, makes decisions that make no sense and run against facts and logic.
You know, this may sound naive, but does the United States have any moral compass? I mean, who suffers first when these sanctions are effectuated?
The
consumers, little people that have nothing to do with governmental policy.
The United States and the West more generally are morally bankrupt. I mean, what we have seen take place in Gaza since 2023 is a genocide, and the United States is complicit in the genocide. If you look at what Israel is doing in the West Bank, if you look at what Israel is doing in southern Lebanon, we support the Israelis at every turn. The Europeans support the Israelis at every turn. How could anybody possibly argue that the United States has a morally based foreign policy? We simply don't.
Here's
that was Professor John Mearsheimer, and speaking of impact of sanctions, we're going to get back to some more opinion in the financial world about Bessent. But remember, the sanctions, as I mentioned before, in a study by the Lancet Journal, over 30 some years, U.S. and European sanctions have on average killed over 500,000 people per year from deprivation and denial of medicine, food, and fuel. All right, so this has been going on for quite a while. Now I'm going to have a brief clip from Professor Jeffrey Sachs, more on a similar theme. Let me just find it here.
Didn't want anyway, but it would have stopped any potential towards nuclear arms, which by fatwa Iran had already ruled out and did not want to create a mess in its own region with that. And the European leaders knew that. But when the United States reverted to this attempt to crush Iran, first economically, then by bombs, and then in the economic D-Day launch today by Bessent. Where are the European leaders? Where's one of them, other than Pedro Sanchez, saying to the United States, are you kidding? Are you kidding? Not one of them. So these are not even leaders. This is just so peculiar. But I'll tell you one thing that's interesting. If readers look at the Financial Times today, if they can one way or another get behind the paywall to look at Scott Bessent's absurd column, if you look at the comment section of the Financial Times, it's quite stunning. Generally, the Financial Times comment section is pretty jingoistic, pretty hard line. This day, it is mockery of the United States, mockery of Bessent, mockery of the economic D-Day. It's not even saying it's wrong or it's misguided or there's a different approach. It's just sheer mockery. Bessent, go back to your hedge fund. You're in way over your head. You're completely incompetent. Scotty boy, you don't know what you're doing. And it's one after another. So it's an absurdity. But where is one European leader standing up and saying, no, the United States cannot announce an economic D-Day to crush another country because that's illegal, it doesn't work, it will bring the whole world economy into further disarray. I'm waiting for one European leader. How about your prime minister? The Norwegian prime minister, a very rational man. Why doesn't he stand up and say, no, we don't talk this way. We don't operate this way in the international scene because that actually will bring us to doom. But so far, I haven't heard one leader. But I take some solace in the comment section of the Financial Times, where I took this article to be horrendous. They take it to be sheer farce. So maybe that's a little bit of relief.
Yeah, I often speak with Colonel.
Just for a break here, he's referring to Norway as he's being interviewed by Professor Glenn Beeson, who's a Norwegian professor of history and international relations, hence that reference.
Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, who will reflect on his time in the White House, when and he explains how they worked very hard to, you know, push the right European leaders into position, and whoever would speak against Washington or, you know, grow a spine, they would be removed fairly quickly. So they had a big system working with political incentives, NGOs, think tanks. Regarding Besant, though,
I asked the prime minister of one of the major countries back in 2023. I said, you know, the Ukraine war is absurd. You know, it's a dead end. Why don't you say something in Washington? And he said to me, Jeffrey, they treat us like children in Washington. And then we were in a room, suddenly the meeting started, so I didn't get a follow-up. But I have thought ever since, 3 years onward, how could a leader of a major country of Europe allow himself and his colleagues to be treated as children? And that taking that as an explanation why you don't speak up in Washington, it's stuck with me very, very painfully, that remark. But I think it is basically what we see right now. We can't hear a coherent thought. And I was going to mention, I think we may have discussed it, the day that Iran was attacked, there was an emergency UN Security Council meeting in which the Iranians, Chinese, the Russians, among others, asked me to testify. The British were in the chair. They ruled me out of order, so I was not allowed to testify that day. But I sat in the chamber. And the day that the U.S. and Israel bombed Iran, every one of the European ambassadors, the French, the British, the Greek, others, attacked Iran. How dare you do this? How dare you strike back at Bahrain and so forth? Not one of them dared to have the gumption to say that a blatant war of aggression and assassination of the leadership of a country of nearly 100 million people and a religious leader at that is not part of our international law. And this was in the chamber of the UN Security Council. So we're in this absolutely remarkable parallel universe where we do not hear an honest utterance by the European political leaders. And by the United States, we know that every utterance is not only irrational and maybe farcical, but is a lie on top of it.
That again is Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Take note of something there that Lawrence Wilkerson was quoted as saying, and also Sachs has talked about this, how Europe has been suborned, its leadership has been suborned for decades by U.S. strategy played out through the State Department, the CIA, National Endowment for Democracy, and other groups of that sort, and also by Mossad and the likes of the Epstein network. So that's a big part of why these people don't speak out, because they've been brought up under the wing of the United States, and that's where their career efforts lie. So, again, on the Iran economy, how much has it been hurt? Comments from Eve Smith and others put it this way, quote, the Trump team has repeatedly brayed that the Iran economy is on the verge of collapse. We have repeatedly cited economist and former advisor to the UAE, Steve Hanke, who argues that Iran was actually one of the two best performers in the region from 2008 to the present, using the metric that best measures broad prosperity. GDP measured on a purchasing power parity basis per capita, much more even point of measurement, not just GDP. When the purchasing power parity, it's like how much does it cost to produce a ton of steel in this country versus that country. So it's a more balanced measure. Anyway, back to the quote. Keep in mind, that was despite sanctions, Iran's performance. Despite sanctions. On top of that, Iran got enough oil out during the time when the U.S. blockade was down at a big premium to its old normal prices so that it will have enough government budget revenue from that to last well into 2027. Unquote. We'll have more insights on Iran after some comments from John Mearsheimer again, this time on the Daniel Davis program, talking about the balance of power in the region.
This is the gang that can't shoot straight. And, you know, if you read the newspapers or you read the different websites where you have various kinds of experts talking about what the likelihood of success of this new economic strangulation campaign are or is, almost everybody thinks it's going to fail. It's not like there are, you know, a handful of really smart people who understand how markets work and the international economy works more generally, who are saying that this stands a really good chance of working. Everybody seems to think it's going to fail, which again gets back to the question, what is the administration thinking? And the fact is, Danny, I mean, what's going on here is that they're desperate. They've tried every trick in the book. They started with a major air campaign. They went to blockade. Then they signed the Memorandum of Understanding. Then they went to tit for tat. Then they went back to blockade. And none of that worked. The Iranians were still standing. And again, the balance of military coercion, we cannot underestimate this. The balance of military coercion now favors the Iranians, not the Americans. When this war started, The Americans were in the driver's seat in terms of employing military force. We thought we had a very powerful hammer that we could use against them and get our way. But as time has gone by, it's become clear that we do not have a military card left to play. Just think about that. We do not have a military card left to play. It's the Iranians who have the military card. If this war escalates, or let's put it differently, if we go back to a shooting war, because we don't have a shooting war now between the Iranians and the Americans, I think in all likelihood, it will be the Iranians who initiate that war. If you listen to the Iranians talk, they talk in very offensively oriented terms. They're basically saying the best defense is a good offense. This is the Iranians. This is not the way they were talking when the war first started. It's not how they were talking in the early months of the war. And again, what you see has happened here is that the balance of military coercion has shifted, I think, almost decisively in their favor. It's a truly remarkable situation. And so here we are trying to figure out a way to bring them to their knees with maximum economic pressure. But if you go back to 2015, that's when the JCPOA was signed, and then ramp forward to 2018 when Trump pulled out of it. Trump said then, I'm going to put maximum pressure on the Iranians. And he has gone to enormous lengths, as did Joe Biden, and has Trump number two to put maximum pressure on the Iranians. But it hasn't worked. And there's no reason when you look at the historical record and you think about how these things work to expect this strategy to get the Iranians to quit. One final point, Danny, before I go over to you. You want to remember that from Iran's point of view, this is an existential threat. The United States and Israel are genocidal states. President Trump has used all sorts of genocidal language in talking about the Iranians and what he plans to do to them. And furthermore, the United States has, along with Israel, of course, engaged in a genocide in Gaza. If you're the Iranians, the idea that you're going to reach some sort of compromise settlement with the United States, or that you're going to concede defeat to the United States, you're going to surrender, is almost out of the question. You have to fight to the death. You're up against an existential threat here. You're up against the United States of America and Israel. And I think, given the fact that the Iranians think they're facing an existential threat, they are extremely unlikely to throw up their hands and surrender just because we've upped the economic ante on them.
That again, Professor John Mearsheimer. And you've heard enough summaries. I think you get the consensus on the critics' side. But I found some really interesting comments about a little deeper thoughts on explaining Iran that I wanted to quote to you listeners. That was the last of the tape comments from other commentators for today. But some really good stuff. Via Patrick Lawrence, quoted earlier from Consortium News, but it's mainly from Trita Parsi, who is the executive vice president at the Quincy Institute, a very informative and advocacy analysis institution. And Trita Parsi put out an interesting piece the other day under the headline, quote, "Why so many countries around the world quietly root for Iran?" And the subhead under this, it's not about Iran, it's the threats that an unchecked America poses to others. Making a pointed exception of the Europeans, as well he is right to do, Parsi further elaborates, quote, "I have been stunned by the number of officials from a wide variety of countries who, while hardly favoring Iran or feeling much empathy for the Islamic Republic, have privately expressed to me a huge sigh of relief over Tehran's success in thwarting U.S.-Israeli aggression. This tacit rooting for Iran tells us something about the state of global affairs. There is relief that aggression and violations of international law did not pay off for the U.S. and Israel in Iran, just as they didn't for Russia and Ukraine. Venezuela was, in the eyes of many, a terrifying case. Regardless of one's view of Maduro, the idea that a superpower could surgically kidnap the head of state of another country, install its favored ruler, who must now get her social media post approved by the U.S. Secretary of State, and gleefully announced that Venezuela is now American territory, was petrifying to a lot of countries. So was the fact that European leaders praised the regime change operation while dismissing concerns about its legality." Unquote. That's it from Trita Parsi, but more for Patrick Lawrence in the same column. Parsi's topic, although he never puts it in these terms, is the creeping isolation the United States brings upon itself at more or less every turn now. The bombing of Iran, Israeli terror, the kidnapping of the Venezuelan president, the inhumane blockade of Cuba, Greenland, the simmering confrontation with Canada that now comes to a boil, all different yet all of a piece. To resist the Trump regime's aggression, lawful or otherwise, on the field of battle or at the mahogany table is what must be done. Final paragraph from Patrick Lawrence. From what I read in the reporting and in the speeches, Trump has lit the fires of passion among the Canadians. Not easy to do, given Canadians are a measured people. May they keep it burning and may it spread. Now, with the final few minutes, I have again some deep and somewhat new to me comments explaining the character of Iran and the nation and the culture we're up against. This is from an organization called Reality Based Analysis Group, author Joseph Busby. The group is based in Vienna, and I got this clip again off the Naked Capitalism site. In January 2023, Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov made famous the Russian term, which I won't try to pronounce, describing the United States as, quote, not agreement capable, unquote, meaning that it was not possible to even negotiate an agreement with the United States, as there is no faith that it will be honored or that there was ever any intention for it to be honored. Iran, too, listened and learned from German Chancellor Merkel's admission of the perfidious Western manipulation of the Minsk agreements to buy more time for Ukraine to rearm and later fight Russia, from Israel's attempted assassination of Hamas negotiators in Qatar during peace talks, from the United States pushing for peace in Ukraine while flooding the country with weapons and intelligence support. The decapitation strikes, which started the current conflict, took place in the middle of peace negotiations between Iran and the United States, negotiations which were so promising that Omani mediators reportedly had already purchased a pen for the signing ceremony, scheduled to take place in Vienna the following week. The assassination of Iranian senior official Alireza Lanjani, critical in the peace talks, and continued threats by the United States president to, quote, end Iranian civilization, unquote, and murder the Iranian diplomatic negotiators if they failed to accept American terms, reinforced Lavrov's assessment as, again, not agreement capable. Perhaps worse, these actions make a mockery of any potential peace agreement short of abject Iranian capitulation. This does not take place in a vacuum. Now, here's the part that I found especially enlightening. The lessons taught in Iran are learned in Russia, in China, in Cuba, in every country that knows that it too may find itself on the wrong end of American attention. The Iranians have been explicit. Foreign Minister Arachi himself has flatly declared that Iran cannot trust the Americans at all. This may be the greatest long-term American strategic failure of this war, a conflict justified to the world as necessary to prevent Iranian acquisition of nuclear technology, reveals itself to be potentially unresolvable diplomatically, as the only offered terms are surrender. A conflict that can only be won by the West by the use of nuclear weapons, and one in which Iranian possession of those very same weapons may have been the only way to prevent the attack, reveals the inescapable logic of proliferation. By murdering Iran's leadership during negotiations, immediately breaking and then misrepresenting the published terms of the Memorandum of Understanding, threatening the annihilation of a country and the genocide of its people and the lives of Iranian negotiators should they fail to accept dictated American terms, the United States has poisoned the well of diplomacy not only in this conflict, but globally. This is our verdict on this war. Expect de facto solutions after further conflict, not finally wrought and carefully followed peace agreements. Barring Israel or United States' use of nuclear weapons, Iran will emerge from this conflict tangibly strengthened politically with a significant and sustained new revenue stream from its control and administration of the Strait of Hormuz, and with deeper integration into the polar order than ever before. Iran entered the war on its own terms, and according to these terms, it will win. Now, there was a lot more to this passage, which I highly recommend, and I skipped the part which gave some fascinating religious historical background to Iranian concepts of honor and dignity, and it was deeper than most things I've read about Iran. And again, that was from Joseph Busby of the Reality Based Analysis Group, posted at nakedcapitalism.com. I believe it was just yesterday. That group is based in Vienna. Now, I only have one more paragraph, and we're just about wrapped up here. I'll turn it over to Don in a couple of minutes. But this I'm repeating from last. I'm not going to repeat that one, but from Gail Tverberg of Our Finite World, one of my favorite sites, about the possible consequences of reduced fuel for the world, which we talked about earlier. Again, not only diesel, but especially diesel. Quote, "The world economy can shrink somewhat if it has less fuel. It can produce fewer goods and services. In some ways, it won't be so bad. but it will likely cause a financial system collapse, I am afraid, because the financial system requires growth to repay debt with interest. The financial system collapse will push governments toward collapse as well. So you see the depth of the not only the military and diplomatic crisis, but the financial crisis, and why many nations of the world are trying to get away from the dollar dominance. With Secretary Bessent had the outrageous gall to threaten to kick people out of the dollar diplomacy, which is absolutely stupid and would be shooting himself in the foot. Threatening to kick other peoples if they're either for us or against us. So, you know, this is the worst and the latest of dollar diplomacy.
Yes. Well, the when these groups came up with the idea of no kings, I thought, oh, yes, Trump wants to just rule by fiat. That's why he's so flummoxed when anybody, whether it's someone in one of the federal judiciary rules against him, and he just can't understand it. He can't understand why Iran doesn't just declare, we give up, we submit to you. But what I think, when Trump added to his collection of places around the world that he wants part of the U.S., he wanted to add the Straits of Hormuz. This is American territory now. Well, that was big news to the world. And the fact that, of course, he wants to make Canada the 51st state, and Greenland, Venezuela, Cuba. And then yesterday, he came up with, oh no, no more Lake Ontario. It's going to be Lake America. So I think he wants to be emperor of the world, where he has total fiat.
Yeah, following that up, This was from last week, but it's pretty good because it's from the voice of Thomas Friedman, you know, one of the most well-known establishment pro-war voice, pro-United States voice in the New York Times, had to admit the U.S. failure in Ukraine. Quote, I wish I could take delight in seeing our pompous, narcissistic, constantly bloviating president humbled by reality, but I truly do not. Because this is getting scary, and it is going to get worse. The Iranians have inflicted real harm on America, on the battlefield, and on our economy, the scale of which Trump and Defense Secretary Pete Testes Hegseth have been hiding. I added the nickname.
Yes. And sometimes I wonder whether Trump has a globe, and he spins it around, puts his thumb, here's why I'm going to cause trouble today. Like all of a sudden he did with South Korea, all of a sudden out of that kind of flummoxed them.
Yeah, well, he'd been turned down on the request for their high-tech missiles because we'd run out for Ukraine. And so South Korea said, no, we'd like to hang on for our own defense. And so that offended Trump and tried to make friends with North Korea again as a retribution.
So there it is, you know. We have all these things that are lacking. Well, this has been the Northern Sun Radio News Show with Dave Gutnick and Don Olson. And as I said at the beginning, we won't be on the air next Thursday because Wednesday and Thursday, as part of the AMPRS, the statewide organization of community radio stations, we'll be at the state fair, and we won't be there, so we'll be back in 2 weeks. So but now it's time for Doug Cain and Global Beat.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
August 1984, NBC was tossing around ideas for a new sitcom, something that had never been done before, like a show based around older women. Writer Susan Harris was told to go off and whip up a scenario. She did, about four women in their 60s or older sharing a house in Miami. The NBC executives looked puzzled. When they told Harris to write a script about older women, they meant women in their 40s. So they gave Harris the go-ahead, and with a team of writers, she developed the cast. Hard-charging Dorothy, played by Bea Arthur, and her sassy mother, Sophia, played by Estelle Getty. Then there was man-hungry Blanche, embodied by Rue McClanahan. And lastly, the role given to Betty White, who for seven seasons on The Golden Girls delighted viewers as Rose, with her font of stories about hometown St. Olaf, Minnesota, with its butter queens, milk diving tournaments, games of go whack